I'm going to open the public hearing, or excuse me, I'm going to first, can, what's the right term? I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm going to call into order the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Daylight savings time still hasn't woken me up yet, apparently. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2218.
I saw it last night.
And I'm going to ask,
thank you.
Ron, Kurt, and Jim from ODFW and the A&H Board to come up first, just so we can have some explanation. I believe there's probably some information that'll clarify the way the bills ought to look, because they're not quite right yet. So we, people who've been reading them might be slightly confused, so let's get some understanding of that.
Good morning, Chair Klim, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator with ODFW. Also with us here today is Jim Morrell from the A&H Board. He's one of our citizen volunteers. And, of course, you all know Kurt, Deputy Director for Admin. What we wanted to touch on real quick this morning is House Bill 2218, which is the A&H bill. What it does is reauthorize the A&H program through 2019, so for another 10 years. It would increase the surcharge from $2 to $4, and it would change the number of applicants that we're required to come up with for the landowner representatives when we make decisions to add landowner representatives to the board. And then the final thing that I wanted to touch on, we handed out a copy of the biennial report for the A&H program that summarizes the program for you, shows the expenditures within the program, and talks about who the cooperators are and some of the real high-profile projects. The A&H program was first established back in the early 90s. The intent of the program was to develop a better working relationship between the hunters and the landowners of the state. And from our perspective, and I think from those that have worked within it, within the hunting community and the landowner community, they would say that we've been successful in doing that. We feel that it's been a very good bridge between the two entities, and we feel that it's been very successful in being able to promote hunter access onto private land and to promote changes in habitat on private land that would benefit deer and elk primarily. Since the inception of the program, we've had over 7 million acres of private land that have been open to public hunting. You know, this last biennium, the one that we're still in, we have a little over 4 million acres that are currently enrolled in 58 different projects. When the program was first set up, it started out with a $2 surcharge. That went into effect back in 1993. That's $2 on top of the cost of a hunting license or on top of the cost of a sports pack or a combination license. It's been set at that fee since the inception in 1993. And we've been able to do real well with that up through this point in time. We actually had a little bit of a backlog of funds within the savings account, if you will, the program. And over the course of the last three bienniums, we've been able to get one-time limitation increases to spend that backlog down. We're now to the point where we've got one biennium's worth of money in reserve, but we're at the point where it's very close on being able to go ahead and continue to expand the program as we feel that the hunting public and the landowners would like to see us do. And that's why we're requesting an increase in the surcharge. And then the final thing that the bill would do is the board consists of members of the hunting public and the landowner community. Within the landowner community, nominations are made to the director of our agency by the state forester, Marvin Brown, and the director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, Katie Koba. They have to submit 15 names to us, as required within the statute. And in talking with the landowner representatives over the course of the last two times when they've had to come up with folks, it's getting difficult to find 15 people for that large of a pool, knowing that some of them aren't going to stand much of a chance, and they feel like they're just having to have their name there so we can meet a statutory obligation. So in talking with the landowners, they feel that it would be very appropriate to lower the number of applicants down to three. They feel that they can still get some good, very well-qualified landowners that are willing to participate with that number of applicants. Yes, sir.
Isn't it five?
To five?
Yeah, right.
Okay, down to five. Thank you. Got on a roll and
I know.
Okay. Wasn't paying attention. So that kind of sums up the bill for us, Representative Klim. And like I said, we've got a copy of the annual report here on page 6. It gives a pretty good breakdown of the accomplishments that have occurred during this last biennium. As you'll see on page 6, there's about 55% of the projects are actually primarily access, and some with a combination of access and habitat, with 43% being primarily directed towards habitat improvements. A couple of the big major things that we've done is for some of the west side forest lands in particular, some lands in eastern Oregon, through the A&H program, we've been able to provide state police protection and enforcement opportunities during the hunting seasons to help keep the lands open. That's been something that the landowners have been very appreciative of. We've been able to provide emergency seeding for wildfires on private lands and private land range restoration, which has been a very benefit to the landowner as well as to big game. And here recently, we've been able to partner up with the NRCS and private entities and landowners with some funding to create a habitat position in the Hefner area that's focused on restoring habitat for pheasant populations, which has a lot of side benefits for a lot of native species of wildlife.
Exactly.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Morrell from the board. He has a few comments he'd like to make.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jim Morrell. I'm from Sisters, Oregon. And I'm a volunteer on the board, as Ron has already mentioned. The reason I'm on the board is because I have a background. I was retired from the Navy after 33 years, and after I did, I felt like I wanted to get involved in something I really believe in, and I believe in the wildlife and hunting and everything in the state, particularly in Oregon. And I served as the state chairman of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation for a couple of years, and then I worked for Oregon Hunters Association for 3.5 years. So I've been, and then I was also the chairman of the High Desert region of the Access and Habitat region over there in Bend for about 6 years, I guess it was, and then I was appointed to the board. So I've spent a lot of my own time in this program. I think it's a very good program, and between Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and OHA, those are the two largest hunter conservationist organizations in the state, and there's probably 25,000 members of the state, somewhere on the order of 25,000 to 30,000 members of two organizations together. They work together on a number of different projects. They probably bring back about $2 million in the state, and probably half of that is funneled back into the state every year. And then we have the A&H program. These two fit together. And then you have the landowners. So what you've got is an amalgamation of people who are interested in wildlife and with the landowner use and with hunter access. And I think all those coming together is a very important program. And I think that, you know, we've been doing this now since 1993, and I'm afraid that if this program is not either supported properly, or if we don't get the fee increase, or the program is allowed to sunset, we're going to lose a lot of ground, because we've developed good relationships with the landowners, with the hunters. We work together very well, and it's not only for the hunters, but also for your constituents who are hunters and landowners, and I think it's very important to keep the program alive and healthy.
Okay. Questions for Jim? Kurt, did you also want to chime in on this one? Or?
Mr. Chair, Thank you very much. My only comment is that the department thinks it's been a very successful program. It's been well supported by the commission, the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission as well, and we certainly think the program has high merits and it's important to continue it.
And just for some of us who are looking at the construct of the bill, it sounds like there's maybe a section that's not supposed to be in there, and we'll get some amendments to make it clear. We're just talking about the surcharges on a annual combination license, or if someone just gets a hunting, or if someone gets an out-of-state hunting, that then those go from $2 to $4.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, that's correct. And on the very first page of the bill, section 1, where it references section 4 in the existing law, that's actually leftover language from the restoration and enhancement sister program to this, if you will. So in an amended version, that language will not appear in this access and habitat bill.
The whole section.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, that's correct.
Yeah. Lines 5 through 18 on the throwing line. We'll get an amendment, but it'll go away.
That's true.
Okay, that makes some sense.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, you're going to get us the actual version. These aren't either one of these bills, right? Are they both going to be changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shoffler, we'll have an amended version of this bill as well as the restoration enhancement bill that we're going to talk about here later this morning.
Yeah, very good. And Mr. Chairman, one more, please.
Representative Shoffler, follow up.
Thank you. The other day I voted for a rebalance bill that, and all session long I've been adamant on. I supported your fee increases 6 years ago, and I believe I can support them again. I'm confident I will. But I've asked repeatedly, I wanted some guarantee, which I don't think there are any guarantees, that this money will not go to any marine reserves or any project that I'm not 100% complete support of. I don't even know, to be quite frank with you, if any ODF&W fees were rearranged or changed around, because it was just so confusing and complex. And I bet you a vast majority of legislators that voted on that didn't know either, because there's a lot going on there. But there were fees moved around that were collected for and used for different reasons, I understand. I just want you to look me in the eye right now and tell me that none of this money is going to be spent where we're appropriating it to right here the next 2 years and years to come. I want you to tell me that.
Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, these dollars we're talking about here are being directed specifically to the Access and Habitat program and nothing else.
And Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Please.
And it's illegal. It's illegal for anyone to use them in anywhere else. Is that true, too?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shoffler, these funds are statutorily directed into the Access and Habitat program, so that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
It would be really helpful if there was a one-pager that showed what the current fees are and the surcharges and what's going to happen later. So when I tried to figure out what a resident combination license issued under all these things, the total cost would be. I mean, I get frustrated at times because they're in three or four different bills, and so we're raising this one and whatever. And so it would be really nice to see what that whole thing is on one page that shows me what the actual cost of these licenses will be with each of these enhancements. So
that's probably good enough.
Mr. Chairman, we're happy to provide that.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. You gave me kind of basically already what he just asked for.
Yeah.
And we went through that list. And that's going to be in 2223, I think, is the other fees and the commercial fees. And we've had quite a conversation, and we're going to have a greater conversation when we get to that. And you are going to be asked at that hearing, so be prepared, because we already got a letter from Ed Bowles of how much license fee money has already been spent to comply with the governor's executive order on marine reserves that was never authorized by the legislature to be taken from the purposes for which it was given. So be ready for that so we have the figures.
Okay. So I've got a couple folks from the public on this bill. No further questions for these gentlemen. I'll excuse them and get to Joe Ricker, Dave Wiley, and Rod Harder. Joe, you're up first if you want to be, at least. Otherwise, you could make Rod go. We'll pick on him a little bit, too, here in a minute.
He spends more time here, so I'll go first.
That's right.
Chair Clem, committee, I'm Joe Ricker from Salem. I'm the Midwest Director for Oregon Hunters Association. And Oregon Hunters Association strongly supports this bill to increase the fees. I'm not going to go through all the statistics of how many acres it's done, because you've got that in that report, so I'll just skip over that in my testimony. But I do want to use one project that I'm very familiar with to give an example on why these fees need to be increased. The Abiqua Basin Project, which is near Silverton, between Silverton and Drace Crossing, opens up about 36,500 acres each year for hunter access. It's private property, and the A&H funds supports this. When we started that project in 1993, it was costing about $1,200 a year to run the project. That fee has requirement for fees has increased in our 2009 request to fund that. The total cost is going to be about $2,155. It's an inexpensive project, but it demonstrates that the cost from 93, 94 to 2009 have just about doubled. The other thing is the number of acres that has been increased in habitat is about 7 million acres, about a million acres of habitat improvements around the state. One of the major concerns of hunters here in Oregon is the decline of mule deer and elk populations, and a lot of us think that its habitat is probably one of those major concerns and major reasons that this is occurring. So with that concludes my testimony. I won't read you all the facts and figures here as you have those. Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions for Joe? Right. We may get one by the time this is done. So.
Welcome, Dave. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Dave Wiley, and I live in Sublimity, Oregon. And I'm a member of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and on the volunteer staff of the state in that organization. And I'm here to represent the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation this morning. I spent, just by way of a little history here, for the first 8 years of the Access and Habitat Program, I was 4 years a member of the South Willamette Advisory Council, and then four more years after that as the chairman of it. So I have some in-depth understanding of this program. And the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation supports 2218 hands down, no issues. We'd like to see the sunset removed, however. It's a good program. Why administratively come back year after year and do it again? Since 1993, the fees remain $2. Inflation has reduced the ability of the program to do its job. And like Mr. Ricker has said, the issue of habitat bears directly on wildlife populations. And a lot of our populations of species that are of concern in the Oregon Conservation Strategy benefit from this program as well. And with that, I've given you some written testimony, and so I'll conclude. Thank you.
Something you said to struck a chord with me. I'm sorry if somebody already said this, but do we have a waiting list of programs that if we had more money in this, we would be able to do more work on access and habitat? Any idea?
I think you'd have to address that. Sir, Representative Clem, I think you'd have to address that to the department.
Yeah, I'll have them come back out. Interesting. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Dan right at the moment? Thanks.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. You'll probably hear me say this a couple of times this year, but I lobbied this bill originally with Representative Larry Soa. This was my bill, along with several others. And, of course, we're going to support the program going on. A couple of concerns that I had early on with the program. One was it was more habitat than access. For a number of years, it was that way. We were not getting our money's worth for the access. In the last, about 5 years ago, that started to change. And I think right now we're, parity has been reached. And as Mr. Wiley said, this program gives a lot of support to non-game wildlife as well as it does for things that hunters use. One question, a couple of questions in my mind. What happens if the fee increase doesn't pass? And this bill passes. So are we going to take the surcharge from the sports pack license then and reduce the other things sports pack license goes toward? And that's just something to throw out. I don't anticipate that happening, but it is a question. And the other is, I would be more comfortable when the agency comes back here if they would give you some specifics as to what will happen and why it would happen if this surcharge doesn't go forward. With that, we support the program and support the increase, all those things worked out.
Great. Representative Shoffwood.
Only to say, I've known Larry, former representative and former county commissioner Larry Soap, for quite a few years, longer than I've known you, and you look, and I'm sure you are, a lot younger than he is. I hope he's watching, but if he isn't, it's no fun.
Thank you for that, but I'm older than he is.
Okay. Any more questions for this panel? Yeah, but Dave, please.
Representative Clem, there is one thing in my testimony that I overlooked. I'd like to suggest that this fee be reviewed on the same schedule as the hunting and fishing licenses and tag fees. Waiting till from 1993 to the present might not be the best approach.
Yeah, let's just talk about that sunset issue for a minute, because if essentially the cost of living, if the fee is small enough that the cost of living is eating into it, that the relevant user groups come and want us to review that every so often, that's sort of like a sunset. You know, we don't raise the fee unless the program's working well, and I think that's the reason you have a sunset, is to review the purposes of programs. And so I think sometimes if you're on a small enough interval for when the fees are likely to be increased, it's functionally the same thing that legislators have to go through, and so I don't know that you need a sunset if you're also deciding whether they're going to get a fee increase. I'd welcome comments from other members who have a lot more experience than me about whether that's actually the case or there's, you know, some different function that a sunset provides than just the same opportunities that happen when there's a fee increase on the table.
Again, Rod Harder for the record. A little background on that. This came up again the last time it sunsetted, and the idea behind it was that we were not getting enough access. We didn't feel at that time we're getting enough access. And we wanted to put a sunset in place to ensure that we would get what the bill originally called for. That was the reason we put sunsets on it to begin with.
And would it have, you think it would have been a different conversation than when they came for this fee increase? You said, not until we get more access, we're not going to support the fee increase.
Representative Clem, you were pretty close to being on target with that one.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for these fellows? All right. So I think before I move on to the next bill, I might have the department just come back up briefly, because I think I'm going to have you on the next one too, probably right off the bat. So before I close the public hearing on this, maybe a few responses to the question about what would happen if it doesn't happen, and then my question about is there a waiting list that, if it were, you know, if and when we had some more funds, publicly or privately, for this program, what would we reduce a backlog, or is there no backlog at the moment?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. We currently don't have a huge backlog. We have some projects that are kind of on hold because we know we don't have a huge pot of money that we can take forward into the next biennium and fund projects. I don't know the exact figure on that, but it's not a lot. We've kind of tooled back until we waited to see what would happen with the surcharge. We didn't want to get people's hopes up and get lots of projects in the works, only to find out we couldn't fund them and would have to back out of doing anything like that. So we don't have a huge backlog, and a lot of that's deliberate on our part as we've kind of put the brakes on soliciting those types of projects. The second question that came from Mr. Harder on what happens if the bill doesn't pass and if the program doesn't go forward, I'd like to answer the second question first. If the bill doesn't go forward, I think we lose a very good tool that contributes to a working relationship between the department and landowners and between landowners and the hunters of the state. And you know, certainly when the bill was first passed in the 90s, that relationship was pretty rocky, and this has worked very well in reestablishing that relationship and helping us all to move together on some common goals. And I think that none of us really want to see it step back to where we were before in the department, and I think everybody would be committed to that, but this is certainly a very good tool to help move that forward. So we would be very disappointed to lose the program because it has proven very beneficial. The second thing that Mr. Harder asked is what happened if the fee bill doesn't pass and we don't get the extra funds. Currently, we would not have enough money next biennium to enlist any new projects. And we would also, there's a list of projects that we currently have enrolled that are due to sunset during the next biennium, and we would not be able to go in and renew any of those projects if the landowners wanted to do so. So we would end up, it's almost a backing out of some of the agreements that we have in place right now, simply because we would not be able to renew those agreements in the future.
Okay. Representative Roblin and then Krieger.
What if the other thing happened? We pass this bill and we don't pass the other fee bill. Would this still just go to access, and then the fee bill, you'd have to figure out what you're doing there? What would the,
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I think our hopes would be that if this package went forward with an increase in the surcharge, and then the fee bill was not supported and somehow failed, that we would hope that the fee bill would at least reflect the increase in this surcharge so that we weren't taking department operating funds to backfill for
that's reasonable.
An A&H bill that did pass.
Okay.
Thank you for the answer. Representative Krieger?
I didn't have maybe paying attention enough here, but what is the total that you expect this to bring in? Have you got a projection of what this would bring in based on your license sales?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, it'd be approximately $1 million of biennium.
Representative Shoffler.
Yep. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why couldn't these just be in one bill? Why do they have to be separated? Is there a reason for that?
Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, our interest was in making sure that these two bills could stand alone due to the sunset nature. And there's, you know, both this and the Restoration Enhancement Bill, the programs have a built-in sunset. And so we felt that it was important to have the policy discussion regarding these programs and their merits, and hopefully the merits of continuing the sunset, not encumbered by all the discussions surrounding our fee bill. So it could have gone, to answer it shortly, it could have gone either way. We chose to select these out and because of the sunset nature and not have them just merely part of the package.
And then may I?
Yeah, please.
And then once again, the sunset is so that we revisit it to look at if it's got enough money in it, or just to not tie the hands of future legislators. I mean, I think there is some argument in just not having a sunset on it. So we could still revisit the stability of the fund or the success or lack thereof without a sunset. So I don't know why that's a big point.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, I think you're right. Every single program in state government technically has a sunset because we come back to you all biennially in passing our budgets and others. But I think the original intent was they wanted to make sure the program was working the way they intended it to work, and this was the best way to assure that review did occur. But
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Well, from my perspective, the sunset means the sun sets dead. So my presumption is that the sunset was put on it because it was a new program. Nobody was sure how it was going to work. And if it didn't work, let it die, sunset it. But if it does work, then you come back again. So the question is, it appears that the question now is, maybe we don't even need the sunset because it's been demonstrated that this is a worthwhile program, and maybe we should just remove the sunset so that the program continues because this committee believes in it.
No, that's a good point.
Representative Roblin.
My concern is the one that other witness prescribed was that at the beginning of this program, we were into getting more properties and so on. We wanted access as well, and buying property costs a lot more money than assuring access. And so when the first sunset came up, the conversation said, look, it's getting a little lopsided. You're into buying. We'd like you to make access as equal. Since then, it sounds like it's gotten straightened out a little bit more that way. My concern about taking a sunset off personally is that it's easy for us to start thinking we need to own it all so we can have access. And all of a sudden, we start putting the money all into that. We've already put the fees up to a fairly high level, or higher level, if we pass this. So we could actually acquire more properties. But that may not be the best use of that money. So the sunset gives us an opportunity not only to talk about the fee increase, but how those fees are distributed across the landscape, and it forces us to look at it. So I'm not sure that I have to do away with sunset yet. I mean, we say it's been evened out this last time. It may get to the point where we think, and we talk to the hunters, that really we'd like it all to go to access and none to acquisition, because access is a bigger issue, and we don't think necessarily that the state needs to acquire more lands. We just need the access from hunters. So I'm not quite sure that I'm ready for taking it off, but I would certainly be open to that conversation.
Is that kind of true? Sort of one way we go about this in other programs is we put in that we want roughly proportional values being matched up. So we use language that says we, you know, want roughly an equal amount of access and habitat. But if we don't know that or we don't want to put that in writing, yeah, then you just leverage the whole program for going away to have these conversations. But again, you know, I'm a member on Ways and Means, and we're doing this left and right to people before they can get a fee increase too. We're talking about, you know, their entire program, policy and dollars, before they get anywhere in Ways and Means. So it's an interesting deal. I don't have strong feelings about removing the sunset by any means, but. And Vice Chair Van Orman reminds me that the other Vice Chair has a question. Thank you. Vice Chair Krieger.
That's what I'm here for. Helpful.
You keep looking to the left. I can't predict.
I'm always
no,
over here.
No, he's always looking to the right.
Wait a minute, I'm down here.
tell us about any money that was swept from the department to balance the budget. Did any money come out of any programs?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, our license dollars are tied to federal grants that we receive, and so there was not our other fund license funds could not be swept, and they were not swept. I didn't bring all my budget knowledge here with me, but we did have a deferred maintenance account which was swept, and I believe we had some general fund that was swept and then backfilled with commercial fish fund, I believe. But Ron's reminding me that we did do some fund shifts in the wildlife division as well. Ron probably has the better knowledge on those ones. If you'd like, Ron, go ahead.
Certainly, Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, we did do some fund shifts within the diversity program and the game program to free up some general fund and actually shift it around to meet portion of an obligation in a policy option package, so we weren't requesting as much fund for match within the diversity program, and then we were backfilled that with a combination of federal fund and license dollars.
Okay. Just want to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we had it on the record that they cannot take that money because of the federal law, the way the excise tax and other stuff that comes in is dedicated. Otherwise, I think it was 2003, they went after it that way, and we were able to find it. And I believe it was Rod Harder brought forward that, hey, you can't do it, showed it to the speaker, that stopped that. But this session, we've seen money come out of programs, and this one here, they wouldn't be able to take it, which is good.
Yeah.
Because when people step up and are willing to pay more for the service they receive, it takes a pretty extreme condition for us to go after that.
Yeah, that's good information as your emissary to Ways and Means. It's good for me to just have that to help defend the program, too, as working knowledge. Representative Roble.
Yeah, I just want to point out, I'm okay with eliminating sunset. Representative Gilliam pointed out to me that sunset changed this last weekend, and it didn't bother any of us. So I should not be uptight about that. So I appreciate his informing me of that. And,
okay, I think I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2218 and open our public hearing on House Bill 2222.
He's the only guy that plants these.
And
based on
are you guys back on this one? Okay. Are you? Who's staying with us from the department on this one? Kurt and Ron? Oh, just, yeah, I'm sorry. Probably just Kurt. Welcome.
Good morning.
Welcome back.
Good morning. Good morning.
We missed you.
Yeah, happy to see you all again. For the record, my name's Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Unfortunately, today, Mr. Bruce McIntosh, who was scheduled to be here with me, has finally fallen victim to the virus that's going around. So I have with me Mr. Charlie Corvino, our Conservation and Recovery Program Manager.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to talk with you about House Bill 2222 and our Restoration and Enhancement Program. I've provided written testimony to you all, as well as our annual or biennial legislative report on the Fish Restoration and Enhancement Program. House Bill 2222 would extend the Restoration Enhancement Program through 2019. Like the Access and Habitat Program we just discussed, it also has a sunset date at the end of this calendar year, and would also increase the surcharge on angling licenses for the Restoration Enhancement Program from $2 to $4. Additionally, it would increase the fish screening surcharge from 25 cents per license to 75 cents per license, and would create a 25 cent surcharge for fish passage to do fish passage projects under the direction of our Fish Passage Task Force. The Restoration Enhancement Program has been very successful over the years. It's been in place since 1989. Over those years, put about $29 million worth of projects on the ground. But more importantly than that, all these projects have important matching funds, whether they be in-kind or actual dollars match, to the tune of about $36 million worth of matching or in-kind contributions. The program has been broadly supported by anglers as well as landowners and other land managers. For the 2007-2009 biennium, a number of projects were put on the ground, and some of those are highlighted in the biennial report that you've received. Also, each of you should have in your packet a description of projects that occurred in your legislative district. The Restoration Enhancement Program is overseen by a 7-member board comprised of both sport fishing and commercial fishing representatives, as well as conservation organization representatives. Currently, the board positions are all filled, and we never have a shortage of interested applicants. I do want to note that the Restoration Enhancement Program is funded not only by surcharges on recreational fishing licenses, but also by surcharges on ocean troll salmon commercial permits, Columbia River gillnet permits, as well as a nickel per pound, 5 cent per pound landing fee on salmon that is directed to the Restoration Enhancement Program. So this bill would extend the sunset date again through 2019 and increase the recreational surcharge from $2 to $4. This would support ongoing projects as well as provide opportunity for new projects. And we had a question earlier about is there a long list of projects under the Access and Habitat program. On the Restoration Enhancement Program side, there is far more applicants annually for project dollars than we have dollars to support. And we do have a long list of projects that we've had to turn down over the last year. Moving on then to the Fish Screening and Passage Program, the screening surcharge has been in place since 1991, and it was a 25-cent per license surcharge to help fund screening projects at water diversions. Since 1991, this program has contributed funds to over 1,300 fish screens and 85 fish passage projects. And these diversions have ranged from very small, less than 1 cubic foot per second diversions, up to very large, 1,000 cubic feet per second diversions. The program provides project design, construction, installation services, and in partnership with private providers. The Fish Screening Task Force is appointed by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, meets annually 4 times per year, and offers recommendations to the Commission on funding of projects. Okay. And lastly, we have a Fish Passage Task Force that's not had any dedicated funds in the past. We are proposing a 25-cent surcharge directed to fish passage projects specifically. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple questions. How much money is in your current budget you're asking for fish screening?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, I will have to dig that number up for you because I don't have it on the top of my head.
Is the funding adequate that's coming in for that program?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, the fish screening program is funded by a combination of federal funds under the Mitchell Act, lottery dollars, and fish surcharges on fishing licenses. Our Mitchell Act funds have been reduced and are continuing to come under pressure on the federal side, so we expect those funds to continue to erode and reduce. And we have also had reductions in our lottery funded budgets. So the short answer is, and then that in combined with just the fact that over the last 20 years, the cost of doing business has increased. It costs more money to install. Materials cost more. So the purchasing power of the 25-cent surcharge over the last 17 or 19 years, whatever it's been in place, is certainly diminished. And we do see needs for additional screening dollars.
Mr. Chair, then you actually need more money, what you're saying, to do the same job. Because from this source, because you don't have it coming from the feds like we had historically.
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, that's correct.
I do know, Mr. Chair, where they can get $19,750. Real quick, because you have Sea Lion Deterrent Project in Curry County, and I have locals that will take care of that problem for you.
Yeah. Chair Clemmer, Representative Krieger, we appreciate that.
Yes.
Yeah, Vice Chair Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Back to the fish screens. We have a group in Hood River, the Farmers Conservation Alliance, that has produced some fish screens. And I was wondering if the department has had conversations with that group about fish screens.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, absolutely we have. We've worked closely with that group. And I'd be happy to come back with some specific screens discussions if the committee would like to hear that. We do have a screening program.
Useful. I mean, one of the issues that I'm familiar with them too, they're not the irrigation district that our orchard's in, but they're the one nearby. And one of the issues is just the need to reduce maintenance on screens, because when you got a lot of moving parts, you got to spend a lot of FTE out there just dealing with the screens. and so this particular irrigation district, to help reduce the need for FTE for maintenance, kind of came up with a different design that in certain slopes and certain situations, you don't have moving parts, and so you have very little maintenance issues, and then you just do more screens instead of spend all maintaining the screens you've got. And so I think that would be an interesting conversation. And some of you would have seen it was on the front page of the Oregonian earlier this year, their particular project, because it's been pretty neat. Representative Roblin, and then to Sean.
I believe it's my irrigation district.
And I appreciate the itemized one for our districts, but the concern, and I know there's another bill, but I just wanted to get it on the record. We do check and trap fish and find out how they are. Do we check? My concern is we have a 10-mile lake, which has its own kinds of problems, but it also has non-indigenous species like bass, which a lot of people like to fish, but it's also a great coho-producing stream system. And so do we ever know how many our bass are eating of the enhancements we're trying to do with respect to step to put fish in the river upstream, and then they go to the lake and spend a little time, and most of them don't make it out of the lake? Do we know the predatory rate with bass and other kinds of stuff? So I'm just very concerned if we're really spending money on trying to enhance a population that we're really only using it to feed another population, that's probably not a really good use of our money. Do we know anything about that?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I know we have done some work in 10-mile lakes. I don't think we could answer that question definitively on an annual basis, what the predation rate is on coho or steelhead smolts in the 10-mile lakes. But I will follow up with our district staff there and find out if they have any specific information I should add.
And follow up?
Yeah, please.
Because I know that a lot of the step people are willing to produce a lot more if they can figure out what it would take to get enough through the system. So one way or the other, or we shouldn't be encouraging bass if we're trying to fix another problem. So somehow we've got to, from my perspective, come to an understanding of this problem. On coastal lakes that are really the coho-producing stream systems, I get a little worried. There's other lakes that I think it's great, but I just get concerned. So anyway, that's just to highlight.
They have those monster stripers in 10 Mile, don't they?
They probably have some stripers. They got more stripers down in the bay than they do. But they have some big bass now. And we regulate, so we wait until they get bigger, which means you can have more small ones, which create a bigger population. And I
think we set the state record.
I'm just concerned about how we spend our money.
It's huge. Representative Schaffler, did you have something?
Yeah, briefly, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I see there's one project in Clackamas County, and that's good. And these are really substantial projects that you're working on. And I have Johnson Creek, not the Johnson Creek alluded to in here, but the watershed, Johnson Creek Watershed Council they've done a lot of work on that. And how much do you work with the Watershed Enhancement Councils? Is there a lot of overlap on these projects with those folks, or is it pretty separate overall, or is there just a mix?
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, this program is open to anyone. Anyone can propose, make a proposal for funding through the Restoration Enhancement Project or Program, and there's a lot of overlap. We do work with watershed councils, both in not just in the R&E program, but also just on the district level.
And may I, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I love this stuff. This is, you know, and it doesn't get any press. You know, every now and then there'll be a little clip about the Watershed Enhancement Council of Johnson Creek or something, but this is stuff that is money well spent, and we're restoring and protecting salmon habitat, all kinds of habitat out there, and we just don't hear enough about it. Matter of fact, we hear just the opposite. And I've heard on ranchers and farmers and woodland owners, both large and small. They're out there spending their money, using their machinery, your technical assistance, or our Watershed Enhancement Council's assistance, and they're doing it all over the state of Oregon. And we just do not hear enough about it. To hear it, read it in the paper, the polluters, the destroyers of Oregon are out there running roughshod over the countryside. And it just simply isn't the truth. And it hasn't been the truth for 50 years. And I just really think we need to spend some money and advertise this, what's going on out there. And give credit to the private landowner who's spent God untold amount, probably millions of dollars, I'm sure, if you added it all up. So I really love what you're doing here. It's a great stuff, and I hope that we continue to do it. Thank you.
I could probably summon some of the outdoor reporters here, and I'm sure you could provide some colorful language that they would love to include in their stories.
I'm trying to refrain from that, Representative. I'm confident I could provide that.
And I just want to make sure, we coordinate this money with the 66 money that come from the lottery and others with the watershed councils to make sure we're getting the best bang for the buck and don't duplicate or whatever. Is that correct?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, that is correct. We work very closely with the watershed councils and with the Measure 66 funding streams to make sure that we're dovetailing.
Because you don't have control over the 66 funds, is that correct? I mean, that comes from another grant program from another department.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, that's correct. Those come through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board.
Okay, I've got six or seven other folks to testify if we're good for the moment. Great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
So we've got a few hundred milers from 100 miles or more. Lonnie Johnson, Gary Soderstrom, and Rod, did you move on me? Well, okay, so it inadvertently got into the 100-mile category. I said you might be 100 feet. Central Salem, but so then how about I get Darlene Klein Dolby up as well? Maybe 100 meters, I don't know. My math a little better. It's like 8 blocks up the street. Welcome. So I've got Lonnie first and then Gary.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here this morning. My name is Lonnie Johnson. I'm from Grants Pass, and I am one of the sport fishing representatives on the R&E board, and I'm the current chair of the board. And some of the things I want to talk about on Bill number 2222 is some of the projects that we have done, how the money is spent, our low cost of administration. We are actually less than 15% of the total cost goes to administration, which is pretty low for a situation such as we have here. In the past biennium, we've funded over $3.3 million worth of worthy projects. On the other side of that coin, we have actually had to reject over $1 million in worthy projects. There are some that don't meet our criteria. Those are not included in that $1 million that we had to reject. We strongly support the $2 increase, we feel as though the R&E work will continue to grow. We constantly have more and more people. I was at the R&E meeting in, I believe it was McMinnville, 2 years ago. We had 46 applicants to cover in one day. It was a brutal day.
I'm really impressed.
And the projection for the Newport meeting coming up in May is 60. So it just keeps getting larger and larger, and more people become aware of what we do and how we do it and our criteria. And our criteria has to keep getting tighter because we don't have the funds. Some of the things that we work on are youth education programs, restoring the fisheries, enhancing, of course. We also provide the money for STEP food. That's the Salmon Child Enhancement Program. And we also provide the money for the STAC mini grants, the small grants that the Salmon Trout Advisory Committee administer. I've spoken to many people, both as an R&E representative, as a fisherman myself, and as president of the Oregon Black Bass Action Committee, which is a group that I head, about this increase, and I have yet to hear a negative. Everybody is in favor of it that I have actually gone out and talked to. Over the course of the 3 months in between our meetings, I probably talked to 250 to 300 people in Southern Oregon. If I may, Representative Roblin, I'd like to address the issue that you brought up with predation in 10 Mile Lakes. The current rule in effect for 10 Mile is what we call a slot limit, where we're trying to get larger bass in there because it's been scientifically proven that as they, I don't pretend to be an absolute
authority on this, but it has been proven by several studies that the larger fish, their diet actually changes, and they do not prey on the smolts as much. It's just a matter of science. I'm very proud of the work we do at the R&E. I'm very happy that the group that we have is cohesive, and we all, being as diverse as we are, tend to work together and work as a cohesive unit. And the work we do is constantly being recognized by people out there, and they really appreciate the amount of funds that we give them. We are very careful about making sure they have plenty of matching funds, and that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, next.
Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gary Soderstrom. I'm a fourth-generation gillnet fisherman on the Columbia River. My family started there in 1872. I'm also vice chair of the R&E committee. This has been one of the most fulfilling things I've done in my life. I've been the president of the Fishermen's Union. I've been on Salmon for All. I've been on advisory councils for this and that and everything. But the R&E board is more like a family now. We're commercial fishermen, we're boat built, we're everything. Sports fishermen, people fish every different type, but we get along. And we're for one purpose, and that cohesive unit is to spend that money for the people that are that put the money in the fund, and we're representing those people, and we're trying to do our best job. But we're running low on funds. We've had to sometimes turn down $1 million in one session, like in McMinnville. Worthy things that came to us, but we didn't have the funds and we couldn't do it. And it's hard. It's hard to sit there when somebody's come up there and talk to you and show you this program that's just beautiful. There's restoration in it. There's education. But you got to tell them no, because the funds aren't there. And another 2 cents would make a big difference. And with the state, with the Fish and Game's budget getting tighter, we're asked to do more of this maintenance on the hatcheries and replace liberation trucks and stuff like this. And these funds would be great to have. On the commercial side of the funding, we pay nickel a pound. We pay $75 on our permit fees goes into it. We're not asking for a commercial increase at this time because our fisheries are going down. As you're reading the papers, there's probably going to be very, very little trolling on the coast. We're not even going to get a commercial fishery on the spring salmon, maybe just a small one up by Bonneville Dam. So our poundage fees are going down fast under ESA constraints. It's not so much that there aren't fish to catch, it's that we're being constrained, which, you know, to allow these fisheries to rebound. So that's where our funding is starting to slip. That's why we're only like at 12-13% of the money that comes into R&E from the commercial side is because of the loss of the poundage fee. And I personally love restoration work. I serve on the Lower Columbia River Watershed Council, and we've spent some money in Eastern Oregon on the Grand Ronde. We protected a couple miles of habitat right through the Grand to help. We helped finance it. We didn't do it ourselves. There was other matching funds for it. We protected a mile of the Middle Fork of the John Day. They went in and were in an area where they'd straightened it in the 40s. A guy got an award for channelizing it, just making a straight shot. We helped. We put $100,000 back into getting the meander back so there was more habitat for young salmon and steelhead to rear in there and for spawning. We fill in a lot of voids and matches. It's really great when you see these projects come and there will be 10 other organizations putting money at them. And here might be the one little hole that they need to fill to get this project complete. And we do that a lot. Very seldom are we asked to do by ourselves, and a lot of times those don't get very high regards from the board, because we like to see people that went out and scratched up other money for this. Some of the most satisfying things I've had, we've gotten from where we've spent a lot of money on education and building fishing opportunities for kids. We've gotten folders back from second graders with all these crayon pictures of the fish they were working with and the little stories that they came up with. You know, and this means a lot when you're on these boards to see that it's really getting to the people that need it, the children. Thank you.
Thank you. Donnie.
Vice Chair Van Orman and committee members, I too love this stuff. My name is Darlene Klein-Dalby. I'm the sports fishing representative on the Arnie board from Eugene, Oregon. And my fellow cohorts here have touched a lot of bases. I hope you all have an opportunity to go through here and look at some of the projects. And on the back page, you're going to see how we cover the state of Oregon. Every single county has some projects in it, and some have multiple projects. As a representative of sports fishing, personally, I'm a fly fisherman, and I belong to several fly fishing organizations. But one of the nice things about the committee is we have fishermen, anglers, fisherwomen from all areas of this, of sport fishing and commercial fishing. Sport fishing dollars are spent on sport fishing projects. Commercial dollars are spent on commercial projects. And I personally have learned a lot. It's been a very healthy thing for me. I've learned a lot about the commercial fishing and the warm water fishing. They've talked about some of the projects. There's a lot of education projects out there. We work with schools. There's the Kids in Creeks program. There's the Kokanee Carnival over in Bend, which is just, it's been an ongoing project, but it's a wonderful educational project. We help fund the cleanup of Diamond Lake, and we are currently funding the monitoring of the water quality there. There are so many projects. I really hope you take an opportunity to review them. I really urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Schaffler, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do. It's no secret to you folks that there's a lot of tension in the fishing world these days. But one thing I found in this building is when you get people that disagree on something, and when you bring them in to work on something they do agree on, that tension kind of eases a little bit.
Right.
Have you seen that happen? I mean, we have a sports fisherman and a commercial fisherman sitting right next to one another. Have you seen that? I mean, it's refreshing to hear you say you've learned a lot about the commercial industry. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that tension or kind of ease and some positive things come about with your being thrown in together to work on these wonderful projects? It's not really, I don't know if it's a question or what it is.
Okay, Chairman Clem and Representative Schaffler, yes, in many cases. Mm-hmm. In some cases, there's still some, you know, ground that needs to be plowed. But in many cases, I see a lot more cooperation than I used to.
Right. It's just, Madam Chair, it's just one of the byproduct benefits of this kind of project, so I'm glad to hear it, believe me.
If I may, Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, I've learned a ton of things since I've been there. And they've also learned that just because I'm a warm water fisherman doesn't mean that I wear a mask and shoot from the hip. And in comment about your comments earlier about the work that we do, hoo-yah. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thank you.
Present everyone, and then we've got about six more folks.
One more comment there, if you wanted to comment. I just wanted to congratulate them on the name of the board, on the name of their board, the Arnie board. I really like that, and I appreciate their choice in names.
Can you top that?
Names and names.
No. We did that to make sure you understood what we were dealing with, though.
Yeah.
Him or me?
You people do a lot of work for restoration, fish screening, all the different things you do, and it's all designed to make the pie bigger, more fish, improve the habitat. And we get more fish in the ocean where we don't have any access to them because presently on the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, we manage to the lowest denominator stream
which is now the Sacramento. Sacramento is 80% hatchery, so now we're being restricted because there's not enough hatchery fish. There's a lot of lunacy what's going on out there. And if you know, what the work that we're doing is great. You know, I was on the Oregon Water Enhancement Board for 5 years, and they worked and did projects. And everybody has given up something, all of our forest practice rules, all of our ag rules, and where we put pesticides and how we do forest management is all designed to improve the habitat, protect the habitat, and make it more possible for our wild fish to be plentiful. But at the same time, we can't access them because of this lowest denominator stream. And that is something we have to work about changing. If that stream's got 80% hatchery fish now, they've got 8 or 9 major predators. They've got dams. They've got water withdrawals. They've got disease. You name it. You'll never get back, possibly, to where you really have access in the ocean to that resource. And there's no reason you can't have access. There are things that could be done, but right now we're not doing it.
Do we know if that's a management council choice, or is that part of the federal law that they're that would need to be changed if that were going to be dealt with differently?
Well, the whole federal process, anytime the federal government gets involved in anything in natural resources, you can just kiss it goodbye because no common sense applies and there is no accountability of any of the federal employees or agencies. That's the first thing that goes wrong. But it's difficult. Pacific Fisheries Management Council, if you talk to the people that are on it, they try to do the best they can within the federal law. But we're being restricted on hatchery fish, not native fish, on the Sacramento. 80%. In Oregon, you don't have a stream anywhere that comes even close to that.
We're not allowed
to do that.
We might add it onto our to-do list for Representative Schrader, who said, give me a list of things I need to work on back there. So I was adding to my list. Okay. Any final thoughts for you all? I'm just going to get some other folks up if that's okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
So, Terry Learned. Yes. Rod Harder and Tom Wolf. As usual, the NRA and Trout Unlimited right here to testify in the same bill of support.
Absolutely.
Lockstep together.
That's right.
Okay, my name is Terry Learned, and I'm with the R&E Board. I've been a member for about 5.5 years. I represent the Troll Salmon Fishermen. Very diverse board we have, and it's very enjoyable to work with. And also, in a smaller part, I represent Pacific City Dorymen's Association. I'm from Pacific City. Very diverse organization, about 450 members, and commercial fishermen, charter fishermen, avid sports fishermen, and so on. And what I'm doing, I'm also a dory builder from Civic City, too, if anybody's interested. All this stuff affects my business likewise. But I'm in favor of the fee increases because of the lack of funding we find many times for the worthy projects that has been mentioned. And one of the things we're finding is as a budget shortage shows up for fish and wildlife, possibly, we're filling in some more of the gaps as we go along. From the 5.5 years I've been on the R&E board, I find that more and more of the projects are hatchery maintenance, emergency repairs of hatchery problems. And if we were to even lose just a few fish because of a lack of funding, that's a loss of fishing opportunity. And so that's what we're trying to do, is enhance fishing opportunity for commercial fishers as well as sport fishers. And I think that this fee increase that everybody is in favor of would help us to further finance these projects. When I first got on the board, some of the projects were only mom-and-pop projects, planting a few trees alongside a stream bank, fencing cows out of a pasture, out of a stream, keep from soiling the water, as cows do. And so I'm in favor of these things. But also, I find from the groups that I represent, they're very adamant. They don't want to see a penny go to marine reserves. That is actually removing us from access to fisheries. And so the Dory Association has really put a statement out, no, zero marine reserves on the coast. That just removes us from fishing opportunities, commercial and or sports. So we definitely don't want to see the money go towards that. And so I'm in favor of the sunset being extended to 2019, and pretty well covered what I wanted to say. Any questions?
Thanks, Terry. Go ahead, Tom.
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited supports passing House Bill 2222. For three reasons. Number one, we do support the increase on the charge for the R&E board. We feel that with decline of Mitchell Act funds and possible decline of OEB funds, that we need this money, and R&E has done a great job of spending money on some great restoration projects, and this needs to continue. The main two concerns I have is the increase of surcharge on fish passage task force, and the increase to 75% on the fish screening task force and 25% on fish passage. I think these are very important. There's currently 1,300 fish screening projects being done in the state of Oregon. Again, with the decline of Mitchell Act funds, these are very important. Fish screen is keeping screening fish out of irrigation projects is very important for protecting down migrating smolts. It is a great use of money, and again, we're probably going to see less Mitchell Act funds to help with this, less OEB money to help with this, and the adding 25 cents to fish passage, that's very important too. We need to continue to work on these different projects on fish passage, and we hope that you would consider and increase and support this fee increase. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, National Rifle Association Oregon consultant, and also for the record, and to ease the panic I'm feeling from the agency in the back of the room, I'm not doing fish. My concern is the same as I expressed on the Access and Habitat Board, and that's the increase from 125 to 155 on the sport pack license, in which I also have some parental ownership. I would like to see some inventive ways by those of you on the Ways and Means Committee to make sure this doesn't go forward if the fee increase package does not. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Roblin.
More of a statement. If Oregonians haven't gone to Pacific City and watched the dory fleet go out or come back, and, you know, it's one of the two places in Oregon where the fishermen go out every day and come back in and get out of the water, the dory fleet, and then down in Port Orford. Yep. And it's interesting. They do it differently in Port Orford, a little differently than you guys do. It's really something that people should do to understand, you know, some traditional fishing things that we've done in Oregon for a long, long time. And it's something people need to look at. So just want to encourage people to do that.
Questions for this panel? You're released. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Last three, Joe Rollator, Julie O'Shea, and John Borden.
Go ahead if you'd like.
Sure. Chair Clem and representatives, my name is Julie Davies O'Shea, and I'm actually here for Farmers Conservation Alliance. I'm the executive director. I was hidden in my glasses. Apparently I couldn't see without them all these years. FCA is responsible for taking the Farmer Screen to market. The Farmer Screen was created by the Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River, and after spending 10 years and $2.5 million developing the technology, they patent this fish screening technology, and they license it to FCA under the condition that we take the screen to market, we get as many screens out as possible, and we invest all of our profits into things that benefit both fish and farms. So everything we do has to benefit both the environment and the agriculture. We officially started in 2006, and since that time, we've gotten a dozen screens in the ground. And so we're here to support increasing the fish license funding to get more funding in for more fish screens. For there are 55,000 diversions in Oregon, and most of them are unscreened. Landowners want to put screens in the ground, but because of the limited funding and the significant cost of not only getting a screen in the ground, but enduring the permitting process, which is a whole other animal preventing, not animal, but... I'm at a loss of words. But another thing preventing screens from going in the ground, getting more funding in is critical for more fish screening. And I actually brought testimony as well. I forgot to pass out.
So, Julie, when FCA then has proceeds, it gets deployed back along what lines?
Essentially, what we do is education and outreach campaigns. So our first campaign, I wanted to mention to Representative Schaffler, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Was called the Rural Roots Campaign. One of the things we recognized as we would travel around the state and meet with landowners is that the landowners are doing a really good job trying to protect the environment. We would get to see ditches, and they've got all their fish in the ditch that they're trying to protect, but they don't have $50,000 to get a fish screen, and they're a little bit nervous about what the process would be like to get a screen in the ground. And we realized that there was such a disconnect between promoting what's happening on the land on the eastern side and in the rural communities of our state to the decision makers in our urban populations, or essentially down the I-5 corridor. We've started a number of outreach efforts to try to bridge that gap. So our Rural Roots campaign featured 8 people throughout the state that live in a rural community, are contributing in an economic way, a significant economic way, and also have an environmental benefit. And we launched it at the Oregon Leadership Summit in December, where everyone who attended the summit had a series of cards sitting at their table, so that by hour 5 of listening to lectures, our theory was people would be so bored that they would start actually reading the cards and hear stories of how farmers are contributing to the environment and ranchers are and whatnot.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. You're from Hood River?
Yes.
May I just follow up?
Please, yeah.
And the irrigation district's involved with this screen technology. And there's a guy up there named Jerry that works up there.
Jerry Bryan.
Bryan.
Yeah. And, but I think it was 2004, I think, and it was clear out to Pendleton for something. And on the way back, I stopped at an Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board meeting in Hood River. And he took me up to look at the prototype, and a fascinating guy, great, it was a great trip, but I will never get in a car that he's driving. But God bless him.
Yeah, I fix his computers at his house. Don't do that either, poor guy.
It's, am I allowed? Yeah, Chair Clement,
please.
The Farmers Irrigation District created the technology, and once they navigated the process, they realized some of the complexities in the industry and wanted to really help farmers get screens in the ground, because historically, farmers put debris screens in the ground. But once the Endangered Species Act came through and additional laws that dictated what type of screen and the methodology for putting the screen in the ground, the process became quite complicated and expensive. And here are landowners who want those screens because it helps keep those fish out of their sprinklers. It saves them. It saved farmers $90,000 a year once they got screens around. So it's a significant benefit to landowners that need fish screens. And, of course, on the environmental side, we want to keep the endangered species out of those sprinklers. And so
and sticks, other stuff that gets in there.
So they patent their technology, and then they licensed it to us, and we're a separate standalone entity responsible for taking it to market.
Representative Beyer.
Well, having been at the summit and seeing the cards that you're referring to, what kind of feedback have you gotten on that?
We did the campaign quite quickly. We realized with the Oregon Leadership Summit that there was a bunch of empty tables, and we went to them and said, if we could get in a really good photographer and graphic designer, could we launch this campaign? And our goal of it wasn't necessarily to have people take action afterwards. It was to start creating a hint to people that maybe there's a different discussion, that in rural communities we often have people doing great work, and then they raise $20,000, and they hire the local photographer and the local writer, and they put it all together, and then they take it to Portland to try to promote it. And when you're competing against hundreds of campaigns from places like Wyden and Kennedy, those never get seen or listened to or heard. And so our reaction to it was, why don't we put together as sophisticated a campaign as we can? We hired someone from OPP to come and interview everyone and collect their stories. And when you go online, you could see all the different photos and hear the people talking about what they're doing. With the cards at the summit, we put them out at all 1,200 seats. Senator Wyden helped launch the campaign. At the end of the day, 600 sets of the cards were gone, which we felt was a pretty huge success. And we've had over 500 people visit the website, 500 unique visitors, to hear those stories. So for pulling it together in 2 months, we were pretty excited for the turnout. And this year, we're actually looking at doing it again. And we're hoping to run a series of ads in Portland Monthly Magazine promoting things like fish screening and partnering with ODFW. We've actually been talking to them about promoting the actual effects of a fish screen going into the ground and trying to connect people to those stories.
And Mr. Chairman, briefly, you know, had this, at what scale do you think these screens could be used? I mean, could, if we'd had these in the 20s and 30s, could we built these kind of screens at a scale that could have managed like a Bonneville Dam or a Grand Coulee Dam? Do you have any study on how big you could make these and make them effective?
We feel quite confident we can take our screen anywhere from half a CFS to an unlimited number. We've actually been working with Irrigation New Zealand at looking at 200 CFS diversions right now. And I recognize Bonneville is quite larger than 200 CFS. But with at least an analysis that's been happening on, you know, that we've been using the computers for, that we do on the smaller end screens, it looks pretty probable that we'd be able to get a screen in the ground. One of the things we've been considering is the East Coast is trying to struggle with these same issues with their power plants. And because they take on significant, you know, they're using it for cooling water, could we approach them and do a test project, you know, in places where they don't have a lot of fish screen infrastructure or haven't come to the same place we have out here on the West Coast as some test sites?
There's an interesting video that they've got. I don't know if it's online anymore or not, but it shows some ink in the water passing over where you'd pull from with your from the irrigation diversion. And even the ink, because on the right slopes, even the ink doesn't get down there. It just rushes right over it.
Amazing.
It really is.
Chair Klimt, can I add on to that?
Please, oh yeah.
Another thing that's happening right now is that being a new technology under the standard technologies that were grandfathered in when the laws passed for fish screening technology, we've had to endure quite a testing process on how our screen actually protects fish. I believe we're in our fifth study right now, which is quite expensive, and we've been working with USGS, and they're actually doing our study at the ODFW Herman Creek Fish Hatchery, where they put the fish in the screen and they test damage being done to the fish, and there's cameras in there. And we've just finished the first phase. We're waiting for another life stage to come along to be able to start testing. We should be done by June. But the exciting thing that came out of that, not only is it's looking like our screen's testing out pretty well for protecting fish, is we have a bunch of video footage that's going to be up on our website showing how fish actually travel through the screen. And it's been really exciting to see. You know, they stay right in the middle, and they go through, and you can definitely see that fish are protected that way. And if you think, you know, there's different accounts of 55,000 to 70,000 diversions in Oregon, and if you say 10,000, 3,000 of those are high priority, and since 1991, I believe I heard earlier, only 1,300 screens have been put in the ground, the issue is so, this is such a significant issue, and it's millions of dollars to get these screens in the ground, and we're putting this cost on landowners who often can't afford it, so they opt to walk those ditches and clean them by themselves. They would rather not have those fish get stuck in, and so the more funding we can have, the...
Yeah, and one of the phenomenal parts of it is people who used to just go around and clean screens all day are now working, for FCA, working on how to save more fish, save more money for the farmers to not get a bunch of sticks and fish and other things in there, instead of just going around sweeping screens all day and repairing little motorized parts that were having problems. I mean, it's truly phenomenal.
It is.
Yeah. We should probably move on at some point because I'll stay here all day on this topic. That's probably not wise. So, Joe, do you want? Thank you, Julie.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I'm here today representing Oregon Guides and Packers. Like Rod Harder, I have some parentage of this particular program. I was on the original fish screening task force, and so I have a great place in my heart for this program. My clients support this program and all three of these surcharges. However, I passed out to you the ORSs that describe what the fund, what the R&E fund and the A&H fund is used for. And if you look on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3 in that handout, you see that enhancement is basically new stuff and restoration is basically repairing old stuff. My clients think it's time that we look at that balance. In 1989, when we wrote this bill, there were no other habitat restoration projects for salmon. We funded the first streamside fencing and the first in-stream channel diversity projects with this surcharge on license fees. Now, there are a lot of other monies available for what we called enhancement in the original bill. And I'm not discounting the use of those, but I'm saying that the production side has gone way down in terms of sources of other money. The general fund is going to be cut more this session. There used to be a lot of lottery money that went to artificial production. And so when you review this bill, when you write amendments, I think it would be good to set up some way for us to put more money into artificial production for the people that are paying these bills are the people that fish. And additionally, on line 21 and 22 of the printed bill, subsection D, 25 cents goes to the, it's credited to the State Fish and Wildlife Fund. I understand from the deputy director that that money would go to fish passage. I think you should, especially in view of the sweeps that we've seen recently, non-dedicated funds, I believe you should create a dedicated account specifically for passage and credit that 25 cents to that passage. Again, I really don't want to rain on this kumbaya, but the program is a very good program. We just think it needs some redirection. Thank you.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for letting me visit with you this morning. My name is John Borden, and I'm a lay member of the Fish Passage Task Force, similar yet different from fish screening. And in some ways, our history probably parallels the Fish Screening Task Force, but certainly the Fish Passage Group was born in an enormous amount of controversy. And it brought together many diverse groups, and I was very interested to hear Mr. Schaffler's comments and others about how groups, once they get together, start working together. And indeed, our group shows that's true. In fact, it happened so remarkably fast, we were all surprised. And as a result, we started agreeing on a number of things, including work procedures and priority lists and such like for fish and wildlife to, of course, implement immediately. But we weren't funded at all at that time. So I guess to rather than reiterate much other testimony I've heard today on the subject, I'd simply say that the Fish Passage Task Force is very enthusiastic about House Bill 2222, and we're especially delighted to see if only 25 cents in the bill for fish passage projects. I echo your view that perhaps it should be a dedicated account, but we're not here to like for that. We're here just to say thank you for even considering a fee for this program. They've had, Fish and Wildlife has had one FTE working on this, and we have high hopes and expectations of that person, always have had. The four people have all done heroic jobs. But those heroic jobs were largely brought about by the cooperation of watershed councils and volunteers and OWEB and others, all of which suffer the same funding difficulties that you hear so much about daily. But in any event, we see declining funds from those groups for many of the reasons we've all talked about. So let me just simply close by saying that we support the 25-cent charge that you're suggesting, and if there's any questions I can respond to, I'll surely try.
The questions, let me see.
Great. We've got three more folks to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Borden.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, John. My check mark's not aligned. Brad Staples and Bill Cluding. Brad, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I am in support of House Bill 2222.
Brad, could you state your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Brad Staples. I'm in support of House Bill 2222 to help fund the fish screening sub-account. I've lived in Oregon for almost 50 years, and I've seen our salmon and steelhead fisheries decline because of overfishing and habitat destruction. I make the majority of my living as a fishing guide, and for over 6 years, I've donated my time to the Fish Screening Task Force through the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In that time, I was able to see how beneficial fish screens are, and I feel that myself and the other task force members were able to help the screening department make educated decisions on how to save fish and use the limited funds wisely. The use of fish screens was put into law in 1898. Through the years, some of the original fish screens have been abandoned because of lack of funding. We cannot have that happen again to this current program. This program was started in 1991 and has been receiving 25 cents from each fishing license sold. We are asking that you increase that amount to 75 cents a license. The program has not had any increase in funding in the last 18 years. There's been a lot of money and effort spent on new and existing screening projects. There needs to be continued maintenance for these screens that are saving fish. Without this increase, we will not be able to continue to help our wild fish make a recovery. This program also uses matching funds from other sources to help get the projects done. The fish screening cost share program has been very popular with water users to help keep them in compliance with state and federal laws. It is very important to properly fund this successful fish screening program. There has been over 1,300 fish screens installed in the last 17 years. Does anybody have any questions I can try to answer?
We may have talked ourselves out. Thanks, Bill.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Bill?
Thank you, Chair Clem. Committee, for the record, Bill Cluding, sportsman. I apologize for not, my printer broke this morning. I was going to have this for you folks, but I'll make sure it's on your desk. I have sent this flyer to all the states surrounding Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Canada, Idaho. We have a problem on the Columbia River. I testified in front of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife on this issue. Senator Johnson has wrote a letter to the Federal Fish, Northwest Federal Fish and Wildlife head, and I haven't heard back. It's been 6 weeks. We can't wait. What this problem is, you might remember on the lower river, we had a problem with the Caspian tern, a little bird about like this, but it could eat 5 smolts a day. And there was 10,000 nesting pair on these islands that the Army Corps of Engineers have built through their dredging. Well, it took about 3 or 4 years to get those terns moved to a different area because the only way they came up with was planting grass, and the terns didn't like the grass, so they finally moved. But what we have now, we have 10,000 nesting pair cormorants. Now, anybody will tell you, and the salmon folks, the Humane Society will even tell you that this cormorant is a ferocious predator of young fish. One cormorant a day can eat 20 to 25 smolts. And where they're nesting at is right where our young smolts that we have spent billions of dollars on have to adjust their body to the salt and fresh water. They just can't shoot right on by. It takes weeks for these young smolt to get their bodies used to salt water. Well, we're looking at 500,000 smolts a day. we cannot do this. We cannot allow this to happen. Hopefully the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has heard from Northwest, from the federal folks, but I doubt if they have. What happened in the state of New York, this is what we could do. The state of New York had a smallmouth bass fishery. Now, I know they haven't spent billions on their smallmouth bass fishery, but immediately the federal folks allowed them to go on this island where these pelicans were nesting and allowed them to break every egg on that island. Well, it didn't work. The pelicans just laid more eggs and hatched out, and they continued to almost destroy that smallmouth bass fishery. What they allowed them to do next was go on that island and spray all these eggs with a light oil. And what that did is suffocated the egg, killed the, and the pelican sat there on that egg till the snow landed on its back. Well, the next year, 75% of those pelicans did not come back. They oiled those eggs, and lo and behold, those pelicans disappeared off that island. I was told by the state game that Fish and Wildlife that this would be a very expensive. I said, no, it wouldn't. I said, you put the word out, and we'll have thousands of volunteers show up with their own private spray cans, and we'll take care of this problem. Committee, we cannot allow this to go one more year. Because who gets held hostage when there's no salmon? Representative Krager spoke about the federal folks and the California problem. We cannot allow this to happen. Thank you.
Thanks. And we have another bill and a member here, so let's not spend, I'm not to minimize what you're talking about, but I just want to try and get Representative Witt in on his bill in a moment, and we can revisit at some other point maybe, you know, what the department has in mind and what the legal situation is, what's federal, what's state, what's Washington, because I don't know any of that yet, but I don't want to do it right now. Okay. So, thanks, Bill. We will get back with you on this, though. We're not going to make you wait the way the feds do. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2222 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2628. Representative Witt, welcome. Sorry to make you wait so long. We had really interesting, as you heard, and diverse testimony on a variety of topics.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31. Mr. Chairman, there's nothing that's the wait was fine. I was right in the middle of moving amendments to a bill when I got called, so it makes it even more interesting. To House Bill 2628, thank you for this opportunity. This is a very simple bill that would provide enabling legislation so that the Habitat and Access Board could expend money to acquire lands or easements for greater public access under the Habitat and Access Board. These are merely providing that board with tools, and like any tool in that tool chest, you may not use that tool very often, but when the opportunity arises and you need that specific tool, it is certainly very advantageous to be able to have the right tool for the right job. I think this is an opportunity to expand the public's access to these lands for recreational purposes, and I would also add that this was an item that my chapter, the Columbia County chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association, found to be potentially very valuable. And with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would hope that you would be able to act favorably on this bill and provide the public that greater access that that this bill intends. With that, I would be open to questions, although I do not consider myself an expert on the board's business, and it is my understanding that Mr. Elkins is from the board is here in the audience today. Thank you.
Great. Questions for our colleague. We do have a number of people as well on this one that we would probably be able to ask questions of.
I just have one clarification.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Clem. So just to clarify, Representative Witt, it's simply another criteria added. It doesn't require anything. It just gives them the latitude to open up the criteria.
Enabling a legislation, Representative Van Orman, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
I would just to say, you know, whichever gets the most, the fastest is the best. So I look at this and I hope, I think easements are probably better than the other just because of the cost of these things. But I think all of those are good options to have available. It goes back to the legislation we talked about earlier about, you know, making sure, maintaining the available acres that we have for access to hunting. And I think this gives them one more tool to make sure that that is available. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roblin, I couldn't have said it better. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Witt, thank you very much. I think we're good.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. So, no 100 milers. So, Dave Wiley, Al Elkins, Joe Ricker. Did we lose Joe?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ricker had another engagement, so take I off. Will be representing him.
Okay, Rod, do you want to come?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Well, we wanted to thank Representative Witt for bringing this bill forward. We agree about the tool concept and support that. We had some concerns about maybe we'd get into buying big chunks of land and being tied up with that with the fund, but we realized with the regional, with the structure of the way A&H works, we'd have the regional committees, we'd have the full access and habitat board, and then you have the ODFW commission. So we don't think that would happen, but we again think this is a valuable tool, and thank Representative Witt for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Dave,
Representative Clem, members of the committee, again, my name is Dave Wiley. I live in Sublimity, Oregon, and I'm a member of both Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and Oregon Hunters Association. The Oregon Hunters Association and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation both agree with this and recommend to you the support of this bill. It's just another tool. And as Al said, we're quite confident in the way that the law is written that this purchase of land will not be for large blocks of land. I think it's the intent here is to provide access. And there are large blocks of land in this state owned by the Bureau of Land Management that are landlocked from public access, where an easement purchase would open that up. Thank you.
Thanks. Rod.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, for the record, Rod Horder with the National Rifle Association. We too support the portion of the bill that talks about acquisition of easements. And one of the things that this board has run into is the inability to buy land for easements. I'm concerned, probably a little bit more so than some of the other folks, that for years we've had this body tell the state they should get out of the real estate business. So I am concerned about them purchasing more large blocks of land. I certainly support purchasing for easements, and we do have, as Mr. Wiley said, a lot of land that is landlocked. By purchasing a right-of-way would open that land up. So, again, my concern is only with the purchase of large blocks of land. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Krieger.
I have a little bit of concern, Mr. Chair, with purchase of land, period. I'm going to be very careful when we do it. In Curry County, where I'm from, 70% of my county is already owned by the federal government. On top of that, State Parks has 112,000 acres statewide, 12,000 is in Curry County, and it's taken up basically the beachfront. So we got a tax base for the county to survive on of a little over $1 million to run government, and that's the county that has the less per population than anybody. We maybe need to raise our tax rates, but I think we have to be careful. I prefer the easement way of going about it. I think that serves the purpose long-term better. And if you're going to buy up land, State Parks is doing it. OLWEB is doing it. Now we have another state agency doing it. And it all comes off the tax rolls, and eventually that has to be dealt with.
My thought on that issue, in general, I certainly would agree you're going to go a lot further on easements. But occasionally, there is a situation where, you know, there's a piece here or there that's fairly small, and it's going to get turned into something that isn't going to be beneficial to habitat. And so I could see an opportunity occasionally to partner with some, you know, nonprofit or something. And then the question becomes, if the state buys it, what's it going to be used for? So that's the key part of my next thought, which is when we get our bill that I think you and I did last time, you've probably done a number of times, on no net loss of hunting access, sometimes it could be a piece where something else comes out and then an acquisition comes in, so there's no net loss, but something comes out on the off the tax or back onto the tax rolls.
One other point, I had talked to the department Fish and Wildlife. We haven't built a new hatchery in Oregon since 64. That's not a commercial fish hatchery, and the federal hatcheries, they need to be looking for new sites for anadromous fish hatchery, salmon, steelhead, statewide. And I think that type of an acquisition would get a lot of support from everybody, because we need to use the newest science technology. We're not using all that now. There's a lot of expense to it. And our research hatchery that we had over, I think it's on the Sillettes, Fall Creek?
LC.
Yeah, anyway, LC, excuse me. From that, we're going to learn how to better manage hatcheries, and a new hatchery would enhance that.
Okay, Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, Ron, you raising the concern, because it was certainly on my mind as we took up the bill. I think that one ought to be very, very cautious about the line that's being added to the statute here. I think that while it may not appear at first that it would change the direction of the board's activities, one cannot predict what the board will look like in the future and how things can change over time. And I do actually, my instinct is that adding this particular line about land acquisition has real potential to change the focus of the board. And I share your concern. I probably am more concerned, and I'm uncomfortable with the acquisition part and fairly comfortable with the easement element of it. But I don't believe I could support the bill with the land acquisition element in it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodgard, anytime you mention easement and to hunters, they just smile and get all very enthusiastic. We had discussions about the land acquisition part, but felt that the and tying up big chunks of money, which I've said before, we felt that the system would allow that to air itself out by the time it got to where the final decision rests with the ODFW Commission. We just have to wait and see if this bill were to pass, we'd have to wait and see if that process were able to air those concerns out. That's where we're coming from.
Representative Shoffler, then Roble.
Yeah, I just wondered, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to be for or against government entities acquiring land. And there's good, valid, meritorious arguments on both sides of that. How much, I would like to know sometime, and if you don't know, it's okay, how much land are we talking about here, though, in the overall picture? I mean, and you look at Oregon, it's a big country, how much land are we really talking about that would be taken off the rolls or protected for hunting or wherever way you want to look at it, however which way you want to look at it? I just don't have any idea how much land we're talking about here.
And part of I think the answer is how much is, even if we went from $2 to $4, was it $1 million a year?
Biennium. 500,000.
That's a two. So if we went to four, it would be $2 million a biennium. So I think that how much land could you really buy with this fund if you did blow it all on acquisitions? Or
Mr. Chair,
is that enough of a rhetorical question now that we got the numbers on the table? Yeah. Do anybody want to respond?
Mr. Chair, We don't know what the potential for land purchases is through the department. I do know they had a case situation where they wanted to purchase at one time and they weren't able to because the law, they didn't feel that they had the authority to do so. That's the only incident I remember. I don't remember any list of land acquisitions that they've wanted to purchase through this program.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, hold on. Let me just do a quick time check. Brad, were you for the other bill and not on this one?
For 2222.
Okay, so we just shaved ourselves one. We still have Katie Fast to get to and then the department, and we have 7 minutes. Representative Rowland.
I'm in favor anytime the federal government decides to sell some of the land that we acquire it. I don't know that we need to buy a lot of private land, but federal land, if they ever throw it up and it's good, accessible hunting land, we should
most
probably...
Most of ours anyway, they should give it to us.
I agree.
Declare that so.
number two, and that's why I asked and made the statement when Representative Witt was here. This is a concern of mine, but I know that there are people who would rather sell you the easement through the land rather than give you an easement. They want to sell you the property because it's along a road or whatever, and they'll say, just make a new road, we'll sell it to you. I want them to do those kinds of things so we get access to other lands. So I think it needs to be there, but I think we're making it clear by the record that we're not about becoming a new land buying or agency. We're becoming a selective about access to places that we can get to. And I think that's why you need to have it in, but we need to watch this. And I, you know, one thing about legislation, we can bring it back here and say you can't buy it anymore if they get carried away. And I'd rather... Representative Gilman's a little concerned about that, but
and the program's got a sunset on it.
Yeah,
which was that
so that's why the sunset's there, probably. So okay. We find out what they're going to do with it.
So can I get some other people up here? Is it this panel that needs to answer? You think? Yes.
Well, I want to be sure we all understand the process.
And it's not the department who can answer it?
Well, I don't know who can answer this question.
Well, I think it is, actually. Let me just... I'm channeling what you're probably asking. Can I get Katie and Kurt and Jim at least up here, or Ron, whichever of the two of you, but let's get at least Jim up here, and one of you pick. Sorry, it's crowd management at this point.
Good morning, Chair Klim and members of the committee. Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And the Farm Bureau is in opposition of 2628 due to the purchase of property provision in the bill. 70% of the state's habitat resides and finds habitat on private ground. And it's that habitat on private ground that makes the access and habitat program important to Oregonians, both for improving habitat and access opportunities. I'm concerned that the purchase of property takes away the partnership between the landowner and the hunters that access and habitat's been successful with. You've heard that there are concerns with the limited dollars in the program. We would be concerned that the purchase of property would not only take up the increase that you are proposing with the movement of $2 to $4, but also concerns with long-term management and the cost of that management that the department would have to retain. I think you're all aware that managed lands are more productive, and that's why we see wildlife habitat on private ground and not on federal ground, because of that management issue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions. I know you're short on time.
One quick question for me. If the parameters were set up about sort of categories, farmland, EFU, whatever, forest land, does that help?
Chair Klim, I don't believe so. I'd have to go back to my folks, but we have a strong philosophy that the state is over 50% publicly owned, oppose increased state ownership and federal ownership of ground. I think, you know, happy to have discussions around the easements and small parcels, but I can't make any guarantees.
I know you have a bunch of members that say don't regulate it, just buy it if you really want it that bad, buy it. That's it. I've had those. So
Chair
Klim,
that might be members' positions, right, but no, that is not the Farm Bureau's.
Yeah, I hear you. welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. What this bill does do is grant explicit permission to the agency through the A&H Board to either purchase easements or what we view as small parcels of land that would provide access to landlocked public land. The concerns have been raised about purchasing large blocks of private land and taking it into public ownership. We don't feel that the A&H program was set up to do that. The whole focus has been on access, either to private land or access to public land, and we would want to retain that focus. We have had a few very small incidences where folks have asked to be able to sell us. I think, as mentioned by Representative Roebling, the roadway and land along both sides of the road to get onto public land, and we have not felt that we had the authority to do that. The process for how we can acquire land is everything has to be approved by our commission, goes through the normal state process as far as tax appraisals and book prices, how something might happen. In this case, whether it was an easement or a small land acquisition, it would come up through the local advisory council, which are volunteers at the local level. They would make a recommendation to the state board. The state board would review that. The state board consists of both landowners, representatives, and the hunters, and then they would make a recommendation to the commission. So it's a fairly lengthy process if we're to go into any kind of a land acquisition. That we would have to jump through a bunch of hoops that the commission imposes on us and that also the DAS imposes on state agencies for acquiring land.
Yeah, you have a question.
Yeah, Representative Van Arnam.
Thank you, Chair Clem. So, Ron, is it not a competitive process that there's a point where you have, because I noticed in the booklet that you have projects all over the state. And my presumption was that it's a competitive process. They submit an application to the R&E board, and the R&E board, that's how they filter out what they're going to do. So first, it's a competitive process. So my presumption is that if you want land, that has to go through the same competitive process.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Wormen, that's correct. It would go through a ranking process at the local advisory council. They make a recommendation of either pass or no pass, and then that would move on up the line. And obviously, we would weigh in on something as an agency. We would weigh in with that proposal very early in the process and be looking at it on, does it make sense? You know, is it something that is way overpriced, anything like that? If it doesn't make sense, we would not, as an agency, encourage the project to be brought forward.
Okay. Representative Krieger, then.
Just real quick, as I remember, under OWEB, there were some criteria that they had to do to purchase land.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're talking about these different boards and stuff would do this or that. Perhaps if it was in the bill as an amendment that there were certain criteria to, you know, provide the basis for the need, people might feel a little more, you know.
That or maximum acreages, maybe,
you know,
too?
For the purpose, you know, we're just buy it for what? You know, let's define what we're buying it for. And what criteria you have to meet. You might take a look what OWEB's doing now. I think they do have that.
I think I feel a work group coming on. Yeah, sorry. Somebody's going to be on a work group here. Representative Winger.
You volunteer.
We're having a discussion about one element of habitat access, which is purchase land. And you've said you've come across examples where you felt you needed this. But I guess my question would be, if you weren't granted it, I mean, how much of an impact on the overall scope of what you're trying to do and the opportunities that present themselves does not having this tool really have on the program?
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, the difference is something that you can permanently lock up for public access versus something that is a long-term contract with the landowner that goes away after 5-6 years, is more dependent on funding. So it's a one-time acquisition of an easement or a land purchase that then you have in perpetuity versus the other. The process, we usually fund a project, on these long-term access agreements, they may be for 5 or 6 years, then they have to come back for renewal in a competitive process.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair, please.
But assume that we gave you the easement authority and you didn't have the land acquisition. I'm trying to get some sense over, of all the things on your list and opportunities that are out there, what are we really denying you? I mean, is it 90% of what you've been trying to do, or is it 1% of the opportunities that are out there?
Yes.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, it's probably closer to the 1%.
Thank you.
There's another issue that we may or may not be getting this bill, but if you only had easements or just permission, it's fairly clear, I think, that there's not the liability protection that there is for a landowner who's participating in A&H, or if it were publicly owned, the liability protection that exists. So I'm working with our friends, with the trial lawyers on that, and I don't know how far I'm going to get or not, but I'm trying. But that's another factor for people. Easements don't equal liability protection under current law the way private land ownership who are in the A&H program officially and public ownership provide. So we have to still keep working on that one. So I think I'm going to close the public hearing, but I am going to ask some of you who have concerns to work with Representative Witt and myself on if we could get there on this acquisition issue. I think to Representative Wingard's point, you know, if we just can't, then we'll just look at the easement issue. But I would like to think there's some of the offerings Representative Krieger talked about and some other statutes and limiting the acreages and things that we could get somewhere on that.
Where there's clear lack of access to state-owned lands or something. See what I mean? Where you had to drive clear around here to get to it. Right. Some kind of criteria of why you would do this.
And I had a visit this summer from a hunter over from the coast, and they were showing me maps of places where they locked the gates, and it's just, right. You know, you'd be trespassing to get in there. It's just fairly not good. Anyway, would be the way to say it, politely. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2628 and adjourn our committee on AgNet.